in that previous study together with Brother Wilcox. And I think that the sweet song that we've just listened to, the voices, and I hope you noted the chimes that were there too. The Lord has been very gracious and rich to us so far in this convention. And I believe in the study of the book of Job that we'll find additional occasion, additional reason for believing that God's book is a book of treasures, a book that widens the mind and broadens the intellect and enables us to get more out of life than we otherwise could. It is a wonderful thing about the Word of God that the more we study, the deeper we go, the more beautiful it gets. The more we're amazed at the treasures of the divine mind and the wisdom that is hidden in this book of books. Now in 1914, I was sent out to the Pacific Coast on a pilgrim service, and during the months of January and February of that year, the international Bible studies that were given in the Watchtower at the time were on the book of Job, one of them. And in that time, I had my attention centered on that, of course. And at the same time in the visits that were given to the various cities and towns, I ran across also the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. And as I read it, I thought that that was a statement of the groping of the human mind to learn of man's destiny and what God had made or planned for them. And in it, I'll read a few verses of it, but as I read it over, I was glad to have come in contact with it. And then at the same time, a brother kindly loaned me a book on the book of Job, a little booklet by Professor Moulton of Chicago, in which he went into the Hebrew and delved into the various, you might say, deeper things of the book, pointing out the events that were happening around them as indicated by their discussion. The storm that was coming up and the lightnings that flashed toward the end, the rolling of thunder, and then the voices as it seemed to be departing at the close of the book. And as we look into those, we see that indeed it has been a question through the ages about the destiny of man. What is he here for? And what is lies ahead of us? And especially, why is evil permitted? Why is it that those who try to do right get the small end of things generally, that they suffer considerably, and those who don't care whether they do right or wrong and have no principles but just selfishness seem to spread themselves and to get the best places in life and the most money and the grandest mansions, and everything seems to run their way for quite a while. It puzzles men from the very beginning, and it puzzles these in the book of Job. I want to read you a few verses of that Rubaiyat of Yom Khayyam, and as we read it, we'll see that groping in the mist and getting nowhere. Myself, when young, did eagerly frequent doctor and saint, and heard great argument about it and about, but evermore came out by the same door as in I went. With them the seed of wisdom did I sow, and with my own hand wrought to make it grow. And this was all the harvest that I reaped. I came like water, and like wind I go. Into this universe, why, not knowing, nor whence, like water willy-nilly flowing, and out of it, as wind along the waste, I knew not whither, willy-nilly blowing. What, without asking, hither hurried went, and without asking, whither hurried hence. Ah, contrite heaven endowed us with the vine, to drug the memory of that insolence. Up from the earth's center, through the seventh gate I rose, and on the throne of Saturn sate, and many knots unraveled by the road, but not the master knot of human fate. There was the door to which I found no key. There was the veil through which I could not see. Some little talk a while of me and thee there was, and then no more of thee and me. Earth could not answer, nor the seas that mourn in flowing purple of their Lord for long, nor heaven with those eternal signs revealed, but hidden by the sleeve of night and morn. Then of thee in me, who works behind the veil of universe, you see, here he's speaking of the divine power. Then of thee in me, who works behind the veil of universe, I cried to find a lamp to guide me through the darkness, and something then said, an understanding blind. That is, God hid these things from humanity for the present. And when then in the end of his poem, he gives at least this statement to show that he got this much comfort out of life. And when, like her, O Saki, you shall pass among the guests, the stars scattered on the grass, and in your joyous errand reach the spot where I made one, turn down an empty glass. He drained something out of life, but he couldn't find the key nor understand. And that same question of the permission of evil and the destiny of man has puzzled great minds. We find that the book of Job, coupled with the rest of God's word, does answer the question. Now in those days, as we read about the prologue and see how things were gathering for the story, that those men who were Job's friends, and Job himself, were not among the common people of that time. They were princes in their own countries. And as we read of the countries from which they came, they all are located to the east and south of Palestine. Around Arabia, to the south, Moab, Edom, and to the east, toward the Euphrates. And they seem to have come from those lands. And they were not ignorant then. They knew the knowledge that was available in their world. They give us a patriarchal life in touch with the whole of human experience. These patriarchs lead a full life. There's no narrowness of external circumstances to cramp their sympathy and mental vision. The description of Job's wealth shows that pastoral life is mixed, united with the settled life of agriculture, and that house and tent is used indifferently as dwelling places. Note that the picture stops short only of the enterprise and competition that tends to swallow up life in adding to the means of livelihood. We're doing that now, aren't we? We're adding many things to our enjoyment, but we're swallowing up our life in doing it. We don't have the peace, the quiet, the meditation that we ought to have. Now these princes of the time are familiar with the whole range of the larger world. They speak of kings, of counselors, of judges, of priests, of solitary sepulchral piles, that is, where the great have buried their dead with their gold. Some translations call those sepulchral piles of stone pyramids. Render that the pyramids, as though they had reference to them. Rotherham so does, and Moffat. Egypt is referred to as Rahab, and that is as a byword. Rahab in the Hebrew means pride. It is the poetical name for Egypt. We find in Isaiah, the 30th chapter and the 7th verse, where the two are coupled together and say that Egypt is called Rahab. Then they have marked the lesson of nations in their rise and in their fall. They know of the cities as the abode of the prosperous wicked. They know of the place of prisons, of slaves, of taskmasters. They talk familiarly of the gold of Ophir, of topaz of Ethiopia, of the coral, of the pearls. They know about the mining. They know about the military caps and the robes and the armor of the warriors. They have redeemed from oppression and delivered from the casting of lots. They know about the robber band. They know about the outcasts from mankind who hide in the deserted cities and come out at night to carry on their nefarious trade. Portions of the human race that have been crushed by the greed of others. And then the things of nature are made use of in this poem, in its imagery. The rush and the flag, the spider and its web, the flowers, the ships that ply the sea, the eagle in its course, the fallen tree, the landslips, the stars and their constellations, the water wearing away the stones. Job speaks of his steps as being washed with butter, and the rocks pouring out in oil. Now, Job is a servant of God. That is made evidently plain. The word Jehovah is used in the prose section of the poem or piece, but it is not used in the poetic section. All the poetry uses the term El Shaddai. And there's a difference in the meaning of those two, not in the meaning in their roots, but in their usages. Jehovah is the grand, self-existent one, the creator of all, but El Shaddai has reference more to the provider, the one who enriches and blesses and gives out blessings, generally. And we find also that children of Israel, God is honored here, and yet Israel is not mentioned, the law is not mentioned, Moses is not mentioned, and yet here we find people honoring the same God as Israel honored, and yet outside the walls of Israel. Not a covenant people, but people that love right, and that love God, and that order their lives in accordance with it. Now the book of Job is divided naturally into five sections. The first is the introduction, chapters 1 and 2, and that's in prose. Then comes the discussion by Job's three so-called comforters, who tried to, at least came to comfort him, but failed. And that involves three discussions, wherein each of his comforters says something that he wishes to say, that is, he's impressed by the circumstances, the conditions. And while they come to comfort Job, they accuse him of secret sins. Their argument is based on the then general belief that sin, disease, and evil, and suffering came only as a punishment for sins. And they are pointing out and trying to convince Job that he must have been secretly a very great sinner for such an awful attack to come upon him. For the disease that he had is now called elephantiasis, or elephantiasis, I got the accent wrong. And in it, the skin becomes coarse and cracked and more like an elephant skin. And boils and so forth come all over the body. And it has a terrifically offensive odor. It's supposed to be the worst disease that can afflict mankind, as bad as leprosy, if not worse. And Satan selected it to give to Job. Then there comes the speeches of Elihu, the third section, and then God's discussion, the fourth, and the fifth, Job's submission and reinstatement. Now, in the first prose opening, we are told that there came a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Notice that the sons of God came themselves. It wasn't arranged by Jehovah. He didn't command them to come, but they came. And the wording of it indicates, as it says, Satan came also, as if he wasn't invited, but he came anyhow. And then the Lord said to Satan, "Whence have you come? Where did you come from?" And Satan answered, "From walking up and down in the earth, from going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down in it." But why did he answer that way? Well, in one way, in one sense, that was the job that God had given him. You remember in Ezekiel 28, it says of him, that thou art the covering cherub, and I have set thee so. You see, evidently, Lucifer was appointed by Jehovah to safeguard the human race, to superintend their instruction, to protect them and guide them in the right ways. He is called in Isaiah 14, one of the stars of the morning. It says it in, How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? And so his answer was a correct answer. And the Lord answered him also. He said, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" The word in some translations is excuse evil. And that is a word we don't use very much, but it's full of meaning. For to eschew means to spit out. That the very contact with evil makes you abhor it. Makes you wish to have everything connected with it out of your companionship, out of your surroundings. Notice that God here states that Job is one of the most righteous men in the world. None like him in the earth. And you know in Ezekiel, twice in one chapter, the Lord speaks of Noah and Daniel and Job as though they were the most righteous men that ever lived. And he says that if they were in Jerusalem, in the city, they could save nobody but themselves by their righteousness. Neither their own son nor their own daughter could they save. The reason being, of course, that their righteousness was not actual, but it is because of their belief in God. Unless they could not be a redeemer, a ransomer, for their fellow men. And then Satan answers the Lord, Does Job fear God for naught? He implies that there's a selfishness behind Job's behavior. And there's this to be noticed in the account, that amongst mankind, our greatest trouble is in the noblest of the race, trying to do right, and hindered from doing it by our imperfection. And the general excuse of mankind is that they can't do it. And circumstances and occasions and the conditions around us press in so that we don't have the time and we don't have the energy, and most of the mankind feel pretty much discouraged about it. Some of them to the extent of committing suicide. And he says, that is Satan does, "Hast thou not put a hedge about him and his house and all that he hath on every side?" Note that. And remember it in your own case. that God, as the Bible states, as the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about his people. He put a protecting wall, a protecting hedge about them, and allows only those things to happen to them that would be for their good, and which he could overrule to their training. Mankind is blockaded, as it were. But Satan has gotten so, you might say, thoroughly imbued with the spirit of selfishness that he cannot imagine even a motive for doing good but what is selfish. He cannot imagine a kindly motive and a generous mind, because his own life and whole being are poisoned by evil and selfishness. And so he tries to make out that the reason Job is good is because the Lord blesses him. And he said, if you take those blessings away and that protecting care, Job would turn around and curse you to your face. And so the Lord said, go ahead, try it. See what happens. And so Satan sent various bands and emissaries around, and as it tells us, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And it speaks of it in various expressions there, on their day, meaning their birthday, evidently, that each one had a birthday and invited all the others, brothers and sisters, to come and rejoice with them together. And it says that a messenger came to Job and said the oxen were plowing, and the ass was feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them, and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, before it had sunk in, as it were, another came up and said the fire of God fell from heaven, and burned up the sheep and the servants, and consumed them, and I alone have escaped. And then, while he was yet speaking, another came and said, the Chaldeans formed three companies and raised upon the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped. Job had been surrounded by God's protection. Now on every side, from heaven above, from the south, from the east, he was being attacked and all his possessions taken away. And while he was yet speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking in their eldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose, and rent his robe, and shaved his head, and fell upon the ground, and worshipped, and said, naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave me all these things. The Lord has seen fit to take them away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So in all these losses of every sort, Job charged not God with wrong. But that wasn't enough. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came similarly to the first, and Satan came also. And the Lord asked him the same question, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him in all the earth. A blameless and upright man who fears God and turns from evil, he still holds fast his integrity, though you moved me against him to destroy him without cause. You see, the Heavenly Father permits these things. He even condescends to talk with those who oppose him, to even deal with them patiently. Then Satan answered, skin for skin, all that a man has will he give for his life. Put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll curse thee to thy face. The thought seems to be that while he might be able to lose all these things and still stay faithful to thee, that you take his personal personal health away, strike him himself, and he will gladly give up anything for his life's sake. Most people will. And so the Lord said, behold, he's in your hands, only spare his life. Note these things about Satan's work that he was permitted to do, that he couldn't go worse bet beyond God's permission. Let us mark that and make it certain in our life that in all the devilry that is acted out upon this world, the oppression, the fearful hatred one of another, that not one item is happening but what God is able and has promised to overrule to the blessing of mankind. And not merely overrule it to the restitution, but likewise that the reward and the blessing and the happiness will be so much greater than what was before, that the former troubles will be forgotten. They will more than compensate for the sorrow and the suffering of the present life. Now it takes faith sometimes to believe that when we're awful sick or awful weary and we lose everything we have, it takes faith. But that very experience as brought out in the book of Job is part of God's purpose in the permission of evil. In these three friends that come to work to comfort Job, they know that only the one general idea that sin comes as a punishment or disease comes as a punishment for sin. That something must have been done wrong, and they're certain of it. And they argue very strongly about it, even to the point of angering Job. That's all they know. But the book of Job opens up the fact that God has other purposes besides those in the permission of evil. And coupling with it the New Testament and the Old together, God's promises, we realize that in the bringing into being of all these angels and mankind and other beings later, other races, no doubt, that in bringing them into being, God's love and his fellowship has wonderful powers to give them wonderful enjoyments and privileges that we can't grasp now. But they are so great and so dangerous to handle that mankind and angels must be trained so that they can be trusted with them not to destroy themselves or to injure anybody else. And so 7,000 years have been set apart to enable mankind and the angels to meet every kind of iniquitous deception, every wrong suggestion, every tendency to disobedience, and to learn to meet it with trust in God, to learn loyalty to him, to learn how evil enables you to overcome, good enables you to overcome evil. That the Lord's Holy Spirit has power and energy that is more than able to cope with all the iniquity and evil in the universe. That it's only permitted for training mankind and the angels too, for the great wonders of the future. And so we are permitted to come in contact with everything that Satan can think of. Because these times are going to be the only times in the whole history of God's universe when evil will be permitted. As we read these things from the scriptures, it brings to our mind the thought, while it isn't so stated in the Bible, yet the names given to the world, this earth on which we live, and the statements above it indicate that the only place in all the universe where disobedience is permitted is this one little speck of dust that we call the earth. Satan, all his activity is here, as we learn from this book and elsewhere. The fallen angels are confined in the earth's atmosphere, not afar off somewhere. The name given to the earth, one of them in the New Testament, is oikumene. It means the habitable, and ought to be so translated. It's translated world, but it means the earth as a habitable place. It comes from the Greek word oikos or oikia, meaning a house. Oikos means further than a house, a home. And meno, the verb meaning to remain, to be in a place, to stay there. And so this is mankind's home, as God says, that the heaven, even the heavens are the Lord's, but the earth hath he given to the children of men. In Isaiah 18:45, it says that he has made it not in vain, he formed it to be inhabited, and it's going to be filled with a beautiful, wonderful race of beings. And as the Psalms tell us, that when mankind was created, it evidently was the first creation of any being in a material form that had the ability to fellowship and converse with the spirit beings. And so it tells us that when mankind, Adam, was created as the crowning earthly being, it says the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. It was something new. There had been spirit beings before, but mankind, an earthly, a material being, was given such a brain and such a mind that he could talk with the Creator and converse with the spirit beings and understand them. That was a marvelous thing. And it was a beautiful creation, too. And then this permission of evil. It was just like the putting of the tree in Eden. The Lord didn't put it there to find out whether mankind would obey or not. He knew that beforehand. He put it there to develop Adam, to enable him to gain strength, to see that tree, to know it was there, a beautiful thing, most desirable to make one wise, and in every way good to the taste, but to absolutely refuse to have anything to do with it, until the Lord gave him permission. You and I are learning that lesson. We can go out into the world. We can enjoy their wonderful pleasures that seem wonderful to them anyhow. Their literature, their wonderful music, their beautiful scenery and time. We can do that. The Lord doesn't tell us that he won't let us. He lets us have our free will in the matter. But we've covenanted to give those up for better things by and by and a higher state. But if we do take those and forget the higher things, we'll pay too much of a price for them. And so there's this willingness, you see. The Lord wants people with him that are glad and count it a privilege to suffer for his sake. Because God suffers, not physically, but mentally, in his mind, the sympathy. You can imagine what God endured when his son was in Gethsemane, pleading with all his soul for help, and yet the Lord's wisdom refused him twice and answered him only the third time. It must have taken a wonderful control, self-control, to refuse that most loved one the help that he craved. But it was necessary to show all others, angels and men, that here was a being that would be faithful even if he lost his life itself. And he was. And that same testing and trial will be given to the church and to mankind. They must be so crystallized for good that they love righteousness, that they wouldn't even suggest a disobedience, even if there were no punishment connected with it. You see, this item of fear to get people to go to church for fear of eternal torment, they find isn't working very well. That even those who believe in it most strongly are themselves furnishing the most of the criminals. It's only the love of God, the goodness of God, that leads men to repentance. Well, now let's get on with our study. These three came to worship Job, to comfort Job. And their names are interesting. We might suggest some of them. Eliphaz is stated by some to represent God is my joy. That is somewhat a variation. Some have the god of gold. But whatever it is, it seems to be a pleasant name. Then Bildad, the Shuhite, is the second one, and he is represented as a son of strife, although some say the meaning of the name is obscure, they don't know. And then Zophar means departing. I don't know that that enters into the story in anything, but they're interesting. The location of the places where these people lived, as we've gone over that to indicate it, is in the east and south of Palestine. Now, in the opening, Eliphaz, as it were, politely asks Job. In the fourth chapter, it says, Eliphaz the Temanite answered, "If one ventures a word with you, will you be offended?" Now these had come out of sympathy with Job, and when they saw him afar off, the work of the disease was such that they couldn't recognize him. And in sympathy they came and sat before him 7 whole days and said nothing, quiet and silent. And that wore on Job. It was hard to bear to have these come and sit before him. Evidently, they didn't eat before him. If they ate, they went away. But it looks as though they shared his fasting also. And finally, Job got tired of their waiting there. He could stand it no longer. And he began to curse the day in which he was born. Think of that now. The disease had worked upon him before these came, so that badly they couldn't recognize him. And then it was working and getting worse all of a whole week. And Job cursed the day he was born. And he uses in that third chapter some expressions that are beautiful and that are quoted. The book of Job is quoted quite a deal into the world's literature, in our English literature. He spoke of the fact that he wished he had died before he was born, or died while just at the moment he was born, and that he would have been at rest then. In the 17th verse of the third chapter, he says that in the grave, there the wicked cease from troubling, and the weary are at rest. Tennyson took up that couplet and used it in his May Queen. That's a beautiful poem, and while it has some superstitions in it that are wrong, that nevertheless that thought winds up the poem, "To lie within the light of God, as I lie upon your breast, where the wicked cease from troubling, and the weary are at rest." He says, "There the prisoners are at rest, at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there," and the thought in the passage is that they are equal. There's no small, nobody's greater than anybody else or less, and the slave is free from his master. He would like to have that rest. Pain and ache and sorrow and trouble, the loss of his health and everything, even his wife turning against him, he says, even his servants don't come hardly near him. And he's had to leave his house and go outside and sit on the ashes. And it tells us how these three friends of Job came and cast the ashes into the air and let it fall down on their heads to indicate their belief was that this was a heaven-sent visitation. And it was hard to bear and difficult to understand. But Eliphaz had some suggestions to make, and he suggested in a light, kindly way that Job had sinned and made some grievous mistakes so the Lord wouldn't be punishing him. And throughout these chapters, from the first until the 31st, or rather beginning the third chapter and going through the 31st, is this discussion. And in them are very many beautiful and sympathetic passages showing Job's faith and showing the wisdom and the knowledge of these great men that are around him. But Job says in his answer, admits that he spoke rashly during that first speech. He said, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed," this is chapter 6, verse 2, "and all my calamity laid hid in, laid in the balances, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea." And wet sand is quite heavy, you know. "Therefore my words have been rash." He acknowledges that he spoke unwisely because of the depth of the sorrow. "For the arrows of the Almighty are in me, and my spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." And he says, "Does the wild ass bray when he has the grass? Does the ox low over his fodder? No, I have sufficient cause," he is saying, to complain and to send some message out expressing my distress and sorrow. And in the 10th verse he says, "I have not denied the words of the Holy One." He upholds his integrity. He knows that he has not disobeyed God. And throughout he reiterates that. And their accusations grow more intense until they accuse him of gross sin, that he must have sinned terribly, and that he ought to acknowledge it and come out and the Lord would pardon him. And Job even gets so emphatic in his denial of it that he even says that he would desire to come before the Almighty. Ask God why he challenges him, why he drives him like a driven leaf, why he takes one that has been righteous and has kept his integrity and yet gives them worse than even the most evil are given. Job acknowledges that their arguments generally have many true points. In the 9th chapter, Job answered, "Truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be just before God? If one wishes to contend with him, one could not answer him once in a thousand times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded?" And so he goes on to point out that he is righteous and he has done the best he knows how to do. He even admits that it was possible that he had sins that he didn't know about, but they were not anything that he could deserve. He says in the 10th chapter, "I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why thou dost contend with me. And thou knowest that I am not guilty." And so in his extremity, he tries to bring his case before God. He even wishes that there were a dais man, a mediator, to present his case before God and to have God deal with him. And so he, in their discussion, they agree, all of them, Job and his friends, that it must be the hand of God that is in this. There's some reason for it, but they do not agree as to what it is. His friends think that it is because of Job's sins, and Job is sure that he has not sinned, at least grossly, that he has been, as far as he knows how to be, righteous. And in their discussion, there's quite a bit of sarcasm. In the 12th chapter, Job says to them, "No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these?" And then he goes on his discussion, how God works, and we cannot understand his works. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. He takes understanding away from the chiefs of the people, makes them wander in a pathless waste. They grope in the dark with light, without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man, and so forth. We'll not have time to go into these details. If you could take the book of Job and some commentary on it, and with the back towers, the reprints upon it, it would be a delightful thing to study. I thank the Lord many times for the blessings that I obtained out of the study of this book. And let us go on. The 14th chapter, man that is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and withers. He flees like a shadow and continues not. And dost thou open thine eyes upon such a one and bring him into judgment with thee? That is, why does the Lord do it? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? There is not one. Job admits he's imperfect, you see, and comes from imperfect ancestry. And then he says in the 7th verse, there's hope of a tree, that if it be cut down, it will sprout. Again, its shoots will not cease. Though it grow old, at the scent of water it will bud. But man lies down, is laid low, breathes last, and where is he? As waters fail from the lake, and rivers waste away and dries up, so man lieth down and riseth not again. Till the heavens be no more, he will not awake nor be raised out of his sleep. O, that thou wouldst hide me in Sheol, that thou wouldst conceal me until thy wrath, this present permission of evil and God's curse of death upon the race, until that be past. Thou wouldst appoint me a set time, and remember me. Yes, Job wanted to be remembered. He didn't want God to forget him. He wanted life. And then he asked the age-old question, if a man die, shall he live again? Notice he does not say, where is he now, or where is he living? Job knew better. He knew the truth about the soul. If a man die, shall he live again? Will he ever live again? And he answers as far as his own faith goes. All the days of my service or appointed time will I wait in the grave till my release should come. Then thou shalt call, and I will answer thee, even as Lazarus answered the call of Jesus. Thou wouldest long for the work of thy hands, that is, for the human body that he has created. And so he points out there the fact that he believes in a resurrection, that he hopes for it. And then the discussion goes on, and in the 19th chapter, he brings out some other precious thoughts. He says in the second verse, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with your words, your accusations? These 10 times you have cast reproach upon me, and are not ashamed to do me wrong. Even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself. If indeed you magnify yourselves against me and make my humiliation an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. And in this he goes on increasing in climax. And in that he tells us, oh, that my words were written, that they were inscribed in a book, oh, that with iron pen and lead they were graven in the rock forever. You see, engraving was known and carried on at that time. And then he says, for I know that my Redeemer lives. Now note that he uses the present tense in the verb, not that the Redeemer is going to live, but that he is alive now. In other words, Job was speaking more than he understood, that the Redeemer was then alive, and that at last he will stand upon the earth, or as we have it in the King James, he will stand in the latter day upon the earth. And stand means to take control, to assume authority. As Daniel put it, at that time shall Michael stand up. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, then without my flesh I shall see God. This is the Revised Standard Version I'm reading. Whom I shall see in my sight, and my eyes shall behold and not another, though my heart faints within me. And so there he tells us still more keenly that he believes in the resurrection, and that he's going to see his Redeemer, and that he's going to see his God with his own eyes and not another. That means a personal resurrection. And so the story goes on until the 31st chapter is reached. Then the other friends have exhausted their arguments, and Job also has finished his in the 31st chapter at its end. It says, the words of Job are ended. And then begins a little prose, and Elihu speaks. And it's odd that Elihu comes upon the scene not as one of the three, but as an extra personage. And furthermore, that while the other three are mentioned in the conclusion of the chapter of the book, Elihu is not mentioned at all in that conclusion. But Elihu spoke words that were right. He gave a right description of God. And he tells Job that man cannot understand God's way. That Job is there, and he has spoken foolishly, and he suffers terribly, but we can't fathom why God has permitted it. There's a reason, but he doesn't know what. But he generally speaks of the goodness of God and the power of God, and asks Job various questions that indicate that Elihu had a better understanding, though he was a younger man. Now his statement about his relationships. Elihu was of the kindred of Ram, and some have thought that that indicates that he was related to Abraham. Not directly, but through family relationships. And then Elihu mentions that there's a storm gathering. He says in the 37th chapter, and now men cannot look on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. Out of the north comes a golden splendor. God is clothed with terrible majesty. The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power and justice and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit. And so the storm was gathering, and it tells us how the cattle were lowing, and the preparations were coming. And then the thunder commenced, and the lightning flashed, and God answered Job out of the whirlwind. And while we cannot go, haven't the time to go into the details of all that, you've been over it. The argument of the Lord seems to be that Job, these things so they show that my power and ability and wisdom is so great. Could you not trust me, Job? Could you not realize that there must be a reason beyond all this that is an adequate reason? That there will be, in the end, something accomplished that makes this suffering worthwhile? That's what the argument means. Calling Job's attention that the Almighty was so far above him that he should have trusted him. But you know, in misery, it's hard to trust. When there's blackness and no sign of the Father's sympathy, no evidence of his hand or his guiding influence about you, then it is dark. But that's the very purpose of the permission of darkness, to get you so accustomed to trusting the Lord, though there isn't any evidence of his sympathy, though he seems to have left you entirely, to know absolutely that he is there just the same. And he loves you just as deeply. And he wants you out of this darkness to realize that he is interested in you and has more and better things for you, and that this is just a training, just a preparation for the blessings that are ahead. And so we get that this permission of evil has a larger view. And the story of the book of Job tells us that in the outworking of it, there is a wonderful training that there will never be, could not be, the character development could not be reached so much by any other method. The Lord wants people so crystallized, so firmly set in the way of righteousness by habitual practice, that evil and sin will be utterly impossible to gain an entry into the universe again. That every being will know that the merest suggestion or listening to a wrong thought is the dart of death and will lose them all that's worth having in the present life. So they will hate it, just as Jesus hated it and the Father hates it. You see, we have a great God, and his plan is so thorough that when he gets through with evil, the universe will be stabilized and safe for the enjoyment of all. And so I think you and I can well agree that we'll help the Lord in that plan, and we'll work with him to develop our own character and build up a crystallized love for righteousness and truth by clinging to it and letting it not be taken away from us by anything. And so, you remember in the end, Job was restored, and his friends came and gave them of their bounty, and his wealth was double what it had been before. And then he gave him 7 sons and 3 daughters. And in the end, you see, Job had twice as much as he had before. Not only in material things, but if he had 7 sons and 3 daughters and lost them, he'll have them again in the resurrection morning. And then he'll have also just that same number more, 7 other sons and 3 daughters. And he'll have double, you see, the number of descendants and children that he had in the beginning. And you remember this lesson about Nebuchadnezzar's experiences in when he was a beast there for the 7 years, that it tells us in the end that my kingdom was restored to me, and my counselors sought me. And then he makes this additional statement, excellent majesty was added unto me, something that he did not have before, that came to him through those experiences. And so there will come to mankind and to the angels and to all beings a crystallization, a stability, a majesty of character that comes through meeting evil and wrong suggestion and learning how the love of God and the love for righteousness and truth and his Holy Spirit enables you to overcome it and to put it aside. And so the names of those 3 daughters, and with this we'll close, is rather interesting. The 7 sons may represent the whole of mankind restored, but these 3 daughters have names given. The sons did not. These names are Jemima, meaning dove, and Kezia, meaning cassia or cinnamon, and Kerenhappuch, meaning a jar of ointment. Those are lovely names, aren't they? And it says them, there were neither not so lovely women as those of Job in all the land. And during these last 3,000 years of the permission of evil, God has developed a church which is symbolized by women, you know, and they will be the loveliest of all God's creation, and those who will be sweetest and will give forth the greatest perfume. So I hope you'll enjoy not only the book of Job, but all the other books, and continue to study and to share your thoughts and to discuss them and to dig, and God will bless you. Thank you.